So, yes, for about 15 years I've been involved in learning how to engineer sugarcane to produce a variety of different chemicals. Most of the focus has been on polyhydroxyalkanoates, and so I'll talk, this talk is primarily about the polyhydroxyalkanoate work that we've been doing. So there's really good reasons for making a biodegradable plastic. The plastic wastes that are accumulating around the world are becoming a massive problem. The sheer volumes of plastics we make in the 300 million metric tons per year, and most of that does not get recycled. It either ends up in tips or it ends up back out in the environment. This is an example of some of the problems we see. The garbage island in the Pacific, there's an island out there of plastic that's about the size of Texas. And these plastics are not degrading, they're breaking down into smaller and smaller fragments, and they're showing up in places we really don't want them, like in the very base of the food chain and some of the diatoms, which many of our sea creatures rely upon to feed. But some of the bigger pieces show up in birds. So birds see bottle caps and other bright and shiny things floating on the ocean, and they eat it thinking it's a fish, and it accumulates in them and doesn't break down, and that kills the birds. And there's lots of other pictures, you know, pictures of turtles with plastics wrapped around them and misshapen. And so the problem is that our economic well-being is based on our ability to access abundant, cheap carbon-based energy, which has been sequestered in the earth for billions of years. If we stopped using that carbon-based material, our economies would collapse. Our civilizations would become very chaotic, and we'd be in big trouble. So we need to continue to use that, but at the same time, we need to start figuring out ways to shift off of that, because those resources, those things that are stored in the earth, that carbon is a finite resource, and someday we will run out. So how do we shift from a bio-based, from a petroleum-based economy over to a bio-based economy? Well, you've heard some people talking about that, and Donald's and his group have made some really fantastic progress for that production. But I think this is sort of the concept, is that very much like a petrochemical refinery, we can start taking the basics of biomass, starch, hemicellulose, cellulose, lignin, oil, and protein. These can be used to make building block chemicals, secondary chemicals, intermediate chemicals, and all those chemicals can be used to basically build all of the stuff that we get from petroleum-based systems. So one of the ways that we'd like to help do this is by doing plant metabolic engineering and actually utilizing that biomass up front. Now, certainly the sugars can be used as feedstocks to microorganisms to make a lot of these chemicals. But if we can also make some of these chemicals up front in the plant, that's going to make the production and harvesting of those plants more economically viable much quicker. So I've been working with a company called Metabolix for about 10 years now. Metabolix is a startup company out of Cambridge, spun out of MIT, and they've been engineering polyhydroxyalkanoates in bacteria and also working in switchgrass. And more recently, they started doing some work in an oilseed crop. So these bioplastics, they accumulate in the cells of bacteria and in the seeds of oilseed crops at fairly high concentrations. And in our case, we're engineering them into plastids and into peroxisomes. And I'll talk to you about that later. But the PHB granules can be extracted, and we believe that the process is from lignocellulosic biofuel production to get the sugars out of the biomass are going to help us get our polymers out much more cost-effectively, so that we'll be way more competitive with microbial fermentation of these types of plastics. And then the lignocellulosic biomass can go for energy or biorefinery. The PHB can go for plastics as a chemical feedstock, as feed supplements, etc. So polyhydroxyalkanoates are linear polyesters. They're produced in nature by bacteria. The bacteria use them the same way we use fats. It's a carbon sink for them, so that on a rainy day they can come back and utilize that. That makes them fully biodegradable. And there's lots and lots and lots of microbes out there that see this stuff as food. So it has properties that are similar to polyester type plastics and can be commercially produced by fermentation. So in nature, there's a lot of variation on these themes. So this is the one we primarily work with, polyhydroxybutyrate. It's got a methyl group on that particular position. But there's other polyhydroxyl counterweights that have longer side chains, and even some that have aromatic groups on them. And when you make plastics out of these different types of polyhydroxyl counterweights, you get very different properties. So you can get a very hard crystalline plastic that can be used to make the bodies of computers and car bodies and those sorts of things. If you start adding in some medium chain length into that short chain length polymer chain, you can get a more flexible plastic. You can, depending on how many of the longer chain lengths you have in the polymer, you can get something that's very elastomeric and even glue-like. And there are companies that are exploiting this. Meridian in Georgia has built a plant that they're making short chain length, medium chain length copolymers to make all of the plastics that companies like Procter & Gamble use in all of their products. And that plant opened up late last year, and products should be coming into the marketplace. The ones with the aromatics, I think, are pretty interesting in that these can be used to actually help PHAs become blends with rubber, and you can actually make tougher rubber products by blending the aromatic PHAs into rubber so that it's more durable and long-lasting. As I say, we've been working on engineering sugarcane for production of these polyhydroxyl counterweights. And so our round one proof of concept work that happened about 12 years ago, we simply took one metabolic pathway out of a bacteria. It's got three enzymes in that metabolic pathway, a ketothiolase, which takes two acetyl-CoA molecules and fuses them together to make acetoacetyl-CoA, and then a acetoacetyl-CoA reductase that converts the acetoacetyl-CoA into a form that can be used by the third enzyme, the polymerase, to make the PHB polymer chain. So the plant supplies the acetyl-CoA and the reducing power, the NADPH. And this is an example of some of the work that we've done. So the top picture up here, that's a cross-section through a sugarcane leaf. This part is the vascular bundle, the two things that look like alien eyes. Those are the xylem vessels. The phloem is just here. And then around this are the bundle sheath, and outside the bundle sheath are the mesophyll. So the bundle sheath and the mesophyll combined do the photosynthesis. They make all those sugars that make sugarcane such a valuable plant. The sugars are then loaded up into the phloem and transported down to the stalk for storage. So this is stained with a Nile Blue A, which fluoresces. It binds to lipids and then fluoresces. So you can see all the lipid membranes lit up in the wild type. And when we go down here and look at one of the transgenics, you can also see these yellow spots all over the place in these cells. And those are the PHB granules that are forming in there. So when we go over here, this is, again, wild type. In the bundle sheath cell, you can see the big starch granules, some lipid droplets. Over here in the mesophyll, you can see the granostacks. When we go down and we look at our transgenic line, the bundle sheath plastid is now full of PHB. And when we start looking at some of the other components, so over here in the phloem, you can see here this is the sieve elements in the phloem, and in each of those companion cells around the phloem are PHB granules, and this is a zoom in of one of those companion cells where they load sugars into the phloem tubes, full of polymer. Over here, this is a guard cell on the edge of the leaf, and here's a zoom in. You can see these plastids, there's two of them shown here, both full of PHB. And then over here, this is an epidermal cell. You can see the waxy cuticle on the outside of the leaf, and here are two plastids. Zoomed in up here, you can see that the mesophyll plastid has no polymer in it, but the epidermal cell is full of polymer. So we were curious why we weren't seeing accumulation of PHB in mesophyll plastids, and we've worked that out over the time, and I'll talk a little bit about that later on. We've also shown that all of the enzymes that we put in are localized in plastids. So A and B are cross-sections through sugarcane. C and D are cross-sections through switchgrass. These are wild types probed with antibody against PHA and PHB. And then down here, E and F are sugarcane. E is PHA with a monoclonal antibody. F is PHB. And so you can see that the enzymes are accumulated in the plastids, in the bundle sheath and mesophyll cells. And we see something very similar in switchgrass. So this is work that was published last year in BMC Biotechnology. So by targeting our polymers to the plastids, what we found was just with a weak promoter, the maize polyubiquitin promoter, we end up getting about 1.8% of the dry weight maximum as a PHB, and that's in the leaf tip of the oldest leaf, and on average we see about 0.6% PHB across the plant. Now obviously this is not commercially relevant, but this was a good start. It demonstrated to us that these high biomass C4 grasses could make PHB. So our strategies to increase PHB included a whole range of things. If we just use brute force and increase the amount of enzyme that's in each cell by using a stronger promoter, if we use an alternative enzyme, if we knock out competing enzymes, or if we use a different substrate, also if we can manipulate the flux of carbon that goes into acetyl-CoA production, all of these things are potential ways that we could increase, and we've tested just about each and every one of those. So the first thing, the easiest thing, was just to put on a stronger promoter, and we did that. We used a maize chlorophyll AB binding protein promoter called the CAB-M5. And sure enough, when we use the CAB-M5, what you can see is that now there's a lot more polymer accumulation in those bundle sheaths. Again, this is stained with Nile Blue A. So the Nile Blue stains all lipids, and PHB in this case is behaving like a lipid. You can also see that there's stuff showing up now out in the mesophyll cells. So when we look closer using transmission electron microscopy, we can see, yes, there definitely is PHB accumulating in the mesophyll cell. This isn't just an artifact of our, you know, slicing through this with our dissecting knives to cut the segments up. So this tells us that by putting a lot more enzyme in, we're now able to compete for some of that substrate in the mesophyll cells. And there should be lots of substrate in the mesophyll cells because that's where lipid biosynthesis is happening. So acetyl-CoA is integral for lipid biosynthesis. So with a stronger promoter, the maximum PHB levels we found in these plants was about 4.8% of the leaf dry weight, and the average overall across that plant was about 2.5%. So that's not bad. We went from 0.6% to 2.5% just by putting a stronger promoter on, and we learned a lot about what's going on here. And so that gave us clues about how we might go in and improve this even more. So in the sugar industry, they often use a chemical ripener because, you know, when your turn to harvest comes up, that's your turn to harvest. They're not going to reschedule. They'll just move on to another farmer's field. So often they'll spray a weaker herbicide on the crop to induce the levels of sugar in those. And some of the herbicides that they use in for ripening in sugar cane, the quizalofops, attack the particular enzyme that uses acetyl-CoA to make malonyl-CoA for lipid biosynthesis. And so we thought we'll try this to actually knock out that competing enzyme, ACCase, in sugarcane. So this is an example of the map of what we use. By using a weak concentration of a chemical called fusalifop, which the South Africans use as a sugarcane ripener, we were able to change the flux of carbon over to PHB production from lipid biosynthesis. And that just told us that the enzymes we're using weren't competing well enough for acetyl-CoA in the mesophyll cells. And this is an example of what this looks like. So we're looking at, here's a small plant that was sprayed with these chemicals. Leaf 1 as the first fully unfurled dewlap down to leaf 5. So this is a wild type stained with Nile Blue. This one is one of the PHB producing lines with a maize polyubiquitin promoter, but that did not produce much polymer, so you can just see a few spots across this plant. And then this is the same plant treated with fusalifop at a very weak concentration, 0, 20, and 100 micromolar. And you can see now with that Nile Blue staining how much polymer accumulates, and it accumulates across all of those cell types. So just by taking out competition, we're able to increase polymer levels. So this tells us that late in the season, we can actually spray the crop with a fusalifop, increase polymer levels, and then when we harvest the whole thing and get higher levels of polymer out. So the chemical ripener, in essence, increased polymer levels by 50%. So the next thing we said, well, if our enzyme is not strong enough to compete, if it's got too high of a KM value to compete with ACCase, maybe we can find an enzyme with a lower value. And just about the time we were looking at this, a Japanese group reported a new enzyme that produces acetoacetyl-CoA in plants. But it does it in a slightly different way from the way ours does. Instead of using two acetyl-CoA molecules and fusing them together to make acetoacetyl-CoA, it uses an acetyl-CoA and a malonyl-CoA, so either side of that ACCase enzyme. And it had a lower KM than the ACCase enzyme. So very attractive to us. And sure enough, when we put this in, it just blew us away. This plant is chock-a-block full of plastic. So as you can see here from the cross-section, all of that bright glowing material, that's stained with Nile blue, and that's PHB. And you can see in the mesophyll cell, all of the PHB that's accumulating there. So this really was exciting, and this was published earlier this year, this work. So it was very exciting to us that we've suddenly knocked up the level of PHB in these plants. So the interesting thing is that when we started looking at these plants coming out of tissue culture, the really high producers like these, they didn't grow very well in tissue culture. We had a really hard time getting them from the tissue culture to plants that we could actually grow in the greenhouse. And so it was actually some of these ones that with much lower levels of polymer, almost undetectable, that we were able to get into the greenhouse to get those results that I just showed you. So when we grew some of those plants up in the greenhouse and we harvested all of the leaves and looked at the polymer level, the total polymer level in each of those leaves, you can see we actually got some pretty high numbers, you know, 11%, 12%, 10% of the leaf dry weight is polymer. If the whole plant was that way, that's commercial. Our estimates were between 7.5% and 15% would make for commercial production of PHB production, depending on the cost of extraction. And you can see here the impact of this. So this is from the maize chlorophyll AB binding protein. This was the best plant from that one that was producing 4.5% PHB, or sorry, 2.5% PHB. And then this is one of those new lines with the NPHT7. Both plants are growing at about the same. You can see that the NBC37, the one with the NPHT7, is a little bit more chlorotic. But it's still growing okay. I don't know how it would perform in a field. We haven't been able to test that yet. But it is producing high levels of polymer. And again, that just shows you a little bit of the chlorosis in there. So there are some consequences to these plants by producing these high levels of PHB. So up here, you can see the different levels of PHB in these plants. The fatty acid levels don't change much, so we're not actually impacting lipid production, which surprised us considering we're actually stealing from both sides of the equation for lipid production. But across all of these plants, it's pretty much like wild type. However, sucrose levels diminish quite a bit in these. Starch levels are depleted quite a bit, and glucose levels are also depleted quite a bit in these plants. Now, how this is going to impact overall these plants has grown in a real field situation, I imagine it's going to be quite dramatic. So now what we're looking at is ways that we can actually change the carbon flux so that we don't have these kind of impacts. We still produce the sugars, but we also keep the levels of polymer up. And Metabolix has been doing some very interesting work in that area, both with an enzyme that works in increasing the flux and a number of different transcription factors that they've identified that increase flux through Calvin cycle. So round three results. More efficient enzyme increased the max from 4.5% to 12.05%. In those really high-producing PHB lines, we're getting about 6.6% total PHB levels, and that's just below what we consider a commercial level of about 7.5%. So we're just about there. So round four is, again, increase the flux of carbon through the Calvin cycle to see whether or not we can improve polymer production. So the idea is that if you can find some enzymes that change the flux to these different metabolic pathways, maybe we can actually improve polymer levels, and we can also reduce some of the physiological impacts on these plants. And this work has been done in switchgrass, and we know that it works in switchgrass. So when they use this bifunctional enzyme, what they find is that whereas previously the best level of polymer in the upper part of the plants was 1.48%, in these new lines with a bifunctional enzyme, it's 5.24%. And in the lower parts of the plants where the total was about 3%, the level jumped up to 7.69%. So more than doubled the amount of polymer in their plants just by adding these bifunctional enzymes. In addition, it reduced the stunting that was caused by the production of PHB and the chlorosis. So it looks like we can change the carbon flux and get some of that growth and hardiness back in these plants. So with the bifunctional FBPase, they doubled their polymer content to 7.7% of dry weight, and that is considered commercial. Now, we're in the process of testing these in sugarcane, so this is an example of some sugarcane material that's just coming out of its transgenic phase. We've just shot the genes in. We've moved it onto shooting material, and this is stuff that's just shooting. This picture was taken last week, so these plants will be moved into, in fact, they were moved into rooting material already and will be hopefully potted up in the next few weeks. This is another plant. Again, this one has a transcription factor in it. So we're testing all these things in sugarcane to see whether or not we can increase the flux of carbon and improve PHB levels at the same time. So to summarize this work, you know, we've been targeting chloroplasts. Our initial round, we got 0.6%. As we went to the next round, we increased the level of polymer to about 2.5% of the dry weight. We used a more efficient enzyme, the NPHT7, and we increased the polymer levels up to 10.6% of the leaf dry weight. With chemical ripeners, we're able to increase polymer levels by another 50%. With the bifunctional enzymes, we expect to increase the PHB levels even more, and at the same time reduce some of the physiological impacts of robbing carbon away from these other metabolic pathways. So we're very optimistic that within the next year or two, we're going to hit commercial levels. And we're now in the process of trying to find sites where we can field trial some of these plants. But we also are starting to move into some of the energy canes so that we can target these crops specifically to these lignocellulosic biorefineries that people are talking about building or are building around the country so that we can value add to that process. In addition to producing PHAs in plastids, we've also produced them in peroxisome. How's my time going?
5 minutes.
So this is a Z-stack from confocal. You can see how many peroxisomes there are in a single cell. So all of those are peroxisomes flowing around there. There's lots. We've targeted the metabolic pathway for PHB into the peroxisomes of sugarcane. And again, you can see all of that PHB there in the different cells. Over here, there's a transmission electron microscope image showing PHB accumulation in peroxisomes here and here. I'm going to just jump down to this one. This is actually showing that PHB is accumulating in the storage vacuole. And that's exciting because the storage vacuoles are the largest part of these cells. And so what happens is the peroxisomes are recycled through the storage vacuole. And I think this work was the first evidence of that in plants. It's been known in animals for a long time. But this is the first evidence that peroxisomes are recycled into the storage vacuole in plants as well. So I just want to talk a little bit about world plastic production. It's predicted somewhere past 2050 to reach 400 million metric tons per year. can we replace plastics that last thousands of years in the environment with biodegradable ones? Absolutely. The annual growth of the petrochemical-based plastics on the world market is about 2.5% year from 2010 to 2015. The annual growth rate of bio-based plastics is from 2012 to 2017 about 26.9%. So lots of new bioplastics are coming into the market, and this market is growing rapidly year to year. And what's really driving this, for the first time, probably about 5 years ago, for the first time what we heard was that the manufacturing sector is saying, we must have bioplastics. We must have biorenewable, biodegradable. That's important to us. And that was the first we've seen that. In the past, it was the bioplastics producers that were saying, we would like to see you use this stuff. Now it's the manufacturer saying, we have to have it. So there's a really good pull coming. Well, the USDA also thinks so. Last month, they had a workshop online. They provide loan guarantees of up to $250 million, eligible applicants seeking to construct or retrofit biorefineries to produce advanced biofuels and renewable chemicals. They also provide financial assistance to eligible bio-based product manufacturers. So this is exciting. The federal government is putting incentives here, loan guarantees, financial assistance to actually help these guys get off the ground. So anyone who is interested in helping pursue this, my hand's up. I would like to join you in that, in chasing some of this money. And I do have commercial partners who are also interested. So if we can build a good enough team, I think we can go after some of this opportunity. So global market estimates in millions of pounds of plastics, as you can see, between 2009 and 2016, it's been increasing quite dramatically. And on the right-hand side, this is all in U.S. Dollars, so we're talking tens of billions of dollars in value for these plastics. And the market's huge. Just some examples of the bioplastic demand. In thousands of metric tons, and you can see that it's steadily growing every year. Global demand for biodegradable and bio-based plastics will more than triple to over 1 million metric tons in 2015. So you can see this is an old publication, and it's valued at $2.9 billion. The fastest gain in biodegradable plastics will be seen in polyhydroxyalkanoate resins. European Union is opening, I think, their third commercial-scale plant for bio-based plastic productions. The Brazilians have the largest plant, and they were certainly the first in the game. And PHA markets consumption will grow from an estimated 10,000 metric tons in 2013 to 34,000 metric tons by 2018, and that looks like it's all on target. So one of the nice things about PHB, though, is that not only can PHB be used as a bioplastic, but it can also be broken down to crotonic acid. A simple acid hydrolysis or heat can be used to break PHB down to crotonic acid. And crotonic acid is a platform chemical that can be used to make acrylic acid, butanol, maleic anhydride, and propylenes. So as you can see, it has a lot of potential here for biorefinery. So it can be multiple products out of one, and so you can target those to the markets that are paying the best. So again, just a reminder, our building blocks are all going to come from bio-based sources sometime in the future. Petroleum's not going to last forever, and now's the time to learn how to do this so that our children don't have to actually go through a period where economies have to crash because we didn't make that transition smoothly. So first commercial lignocellulosic biorefineries opened in the U.S. were Abengoa in Hoboken, Kansas, DuPont in Nevada, Poet, Emmitsburg, Iowa, and the Quad County Corn Adding Cellulosic Ethanol to ACE located in Galwa, Iowa. And again, just about all of this is based on corn-based biomass, the corn stover, the cobs, that sort of stuff. Never guess where I got this one from. I think this is the one somebody said earlier they didn't show because they got in trouble over it. And I did show this at an ARPA-E meeting and I got chewed out about it. But I think it's a good example of, you know, the targets where at least we've started looking at where we can actually grow these energy crops. And my guess is this map has changed a little bit. So if I can get an updated version, that would be nice.
You could add North Carolina in there.
Yeah, that's right. North Carolina can be added. So if I have time to talk about the economics of bioplastics?
Sure.
Okay, so economics. So if you look at the breakdown of a sugarcane plant from leaf to tops, most of the PHAs that we're making and some of the other chemicals are being made in the leaf. So, and right now the leaf is a waste product. It's either burned off or it's left in the field as trash, depending on what part of the world where you're growing your cane in. Louisiana, they don't want it as trash because it insulates the ground and it doesn't warm up quick enough and they don't get the sugar cane up fast enough. In other parts of the world, like Australia, they wanted that trash, especially along areas that drain into the Great Barrier Reef because it keeps runoff from going off into the reef areas. So it just depends on where you are. But the leaf potential as a biomass, the Brazilians are looking at exploiting this, actually harvesting and bringing it in and making lignocellulosic-type biorefineries. So if the assumption is that tops make up 15 to 20% of a sugarcane biomass, I'm calling it 35 tons per acre, stalks and tops, 80 to 85% of the tops are collected. Tops have a moisture content of about 60 to 70%. And 90% of the PHA is extracted, and then the PHA is sold for anywhere from $1 to $2 a pound. You can see what the levels here. So at 8% leaf dry weight, the value would be $300 at $1 a pound per acre. And at 18% leaf dry weight, the PHB would be worth about $675 a pound. If it's $2 a pound, the polymer, $600 a pound at 8%, and $1,350 a pound per acre. $1,350 per acre of PHB. That's just the PHB value. So value adding to that lignocellulosic crop, these polymers could be quite significant, maybe even doubling the value of those crops. The world plastic production is more than 300 million metric tons, 660 billion pounds per year. Using Brazil, which is one of the largest sugar industry, if they converted their entire industry over to production of these bio-based plastics, they might capture 2 to 4% of the world plastic market. And the plastic production is expected to exceed 400 billion tons by 2040. So there's plenty of room for everybody to join in on this, to make these plastics from biorenewable resources. It's such a giant market. Any dent we can put in it's going to be beneficial. And there's lots of other bio-based plastics. PHAs aren't the only ones. So lots of other polymers will come in. So to acknowledge, this is the team in Australia that's done most of the engineering of sugarcane. Richard McWalter just recently joined my lab in the United States. He's working on an ARPA-E project to try to produce jet fuels from sugarcane. Lars Petrosevich was the first guy to genetically engineer sugarcane with the PHA polymers. And Lee has been doing some of the work on the bioinformatics. We've got a paper that's about to come out where we just did RNA-seq analysis on some of our transgenic lines and our wild-type lines. This work has been done with a whole bunch of different groups around the world. We work with Yves Poirier in Switzerland, who was the first guy to ever engineer a plant to make PHB. He did it with Arabidopsis way back in Chris Somerville's lab in Michigan. We've worked very closely with people at the University of Queensland, especially Professor Lars Nielsen, who really helped get this project up and rolling. And then Metabolics, Oliver People, who's the founder, Christy Snell, who's Vice President of Research, Karen Bomert, who's done tons of work on PHB polymer production, and Maria Somleva, who's probably one of the best tissue culture experts I know of. And then this is my team in Australia, or here in Texas, sorry. So the people who've done the primary work on sugarcane now are Trevor. Claudia has developed some of the tissue culture projects. Adi is working on a different chemical in sugarcane. And then all of these other folks, Saifun and Trevor are graduate students. Garima is another graduate student, and then a lot of undergraduates who are helping out with all the day-to-day work. But it's a good group, hardworking. And all the credit goes to them because I come up with the ideas, but they actually make those ideas work. So if I can answer any questions, if there's time for questions. Yes?
Steve, how challenging is the transformation aspect, and as people develop new crops and new variations on the transgenics, how do you see that happening?
Well, with the regulatory processes the way they are today, it's going to be slow and painful. If we can get over this hang-up about genetically modified organisms, then all of this will speed up a whole lot. But I don't think the big six are going to let us get away with that as long as they see they can dominate the markets. But transformation is fairly routine in our labs. From the time we get material into the lab from the greenhouse and shoot it is about 10 days. 4 months after that, we've got stuff ready to go back out into the greenhouse again. So it's a pretty quick process. It's down to just brute force now.
Other questions?